This is the Israel Connection, casting on 88 FM and streaming live over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Dan Diker is president of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs and a senior fellow and longtime director of the Counter-Political Warfare Project at the Jerusalem Center, former Secretary General of the World Jewish Congress, and research fellow of the International Institute for Counterterrorism at Reichman University, formerly IDC Herzliya. So welcome back to the Israel Connection.
It's great to be back on the Israel Connection down under in one of my favorite Jewish communities.
Dan, it's just after 7 a.m. in the morning in Israel, and you're looking bright and awake. And I'd like to welcome you back, as I say once again. It's been 2.5 years since I had you on the show. And let me tell you that last year you took over from Dori Gold, who was the president of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs from 2000 till 2022. Quite an innings, I must say. So you've got a lot to follow after such an enormous person has been in the same shoes that you're now occupying.
Well, you know, David, Ambassador Gold was has been a great not only diplomat for Israel but scholar diplomat on the international scene. He's the author of a number of books. He was the first Israeli author to write in English, the rise of nuclear Iran, which essentially exposed to the world how Iran had tricked the West in its race for nuclear supremacy across the Middle East. And as you can say, the rest is history. We look behind us and see empirically how right Ambassador Gold was, and we look ahead with the same foundation that he had when he wrote the book, goodness gracious, almost 20 years ago.
But you're the man now, so give us an update, please, Dan, on the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Firstly, I understand there's a name change, but what's the objectives that you're forging ahead with at the JCPA?
Well, David, having worked with Ambassador Gold for many, many years at the Jerusalem Center, and having run for him the counter-political warfare initiative, I came to learn over the years that increasingly Israel's major challenge beyond the conventional battlefield, the terror battlefield, as we remember from the enormous upsurge in PLO strategy, Hamas strategy, 1970s, 1980s were decades awash in terrorism, that Israel's main battlefield today is a battlefield of perception, battlefield of influence. It's a battlefield that the Soviet Union, the Chinese, the Iranian regime, and today even Russia have been prosecuting this type of warfare, which we used to call in Israel Hasbara warfare. We used to call this in Israel the PR war. Well, David, I think you, as a very educated commentator and broadcaster on Israel, know, and many of your listeners and viewers know, and we certainly have come to learn at Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, which is really, in fact, the Jerusalem Center for Foreign Affairs. That's really what we're doing. And the foreign affairs war is a war to fight the disinformation, the deception warfare of the four major powers that are today colluding. I'm talking about Russia, China, Iran, even Turkey to a degree as a home for the Hamas outside the Gaza Strip and the areas of Judea and Samaria, in a war of perception, deception, and disinformation. That is the war that today in the Gaza Strip, as your viewers and listeners know, the Hamas has been winning the war of perception, which is why the greatest power in the free world and in the world over, the United States, is today really supporting politically developments that would deeply compromise Israel's ability to defend itself, certainly not only on the battlefield, but on the international battlefield, the court of international public opinion and legitimacy for Israel. That's all a war of perception and deception. One example. You remember a number of months ago, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad misfire of rockets at Israel that landed in a parking lot of the Ahli Hospital in northern Gaza. Well, immediately, within minutes, the Hamas Ministry of Health, the Hamas spokespeople, the Hamas International Relations Division, which they actually have, David, believe it or not, they are sophisticated international relations experts, the Hamas. They're not only barbaric terrorists that behead children and mass rape Israeli girls, but they're sophisticated international terror diplomats that already, the minute the rockets were misfired, they were blaming Israel for killing hundreds of innocent patients at a hospital. I mean, that's all you need to say to the Western world. And there they go. The West goes uncritically accepts this information. And there Israel is once again in the defendant's dock in the International Court of Public Opinion. Well, we know that within hours, the Israeli PR mechanisms, the what they call the Israel spokesperson's office, the foreign ministry, took them hours to really put together the counter PR offensive. And you saw yourself the damage that Israel suffered and continues to suffer. Look at the humanitarian convoys in which Gazans had died from their own doing, firing on their own people, Hamas on their own people, and right away blaming Israel. That is called perception warfare. And that is the war that the Jerusalem Center has been prosecuting as the leading non-governmental body that has fused research policy with diplomacy and communications. We have our own David Shulman podcast videocast center in the Jerusalem Center, and a very high level operation. And we are, if we have the support that we are seeking, we are really seeing ourselves as head of the spear to prosecute this war against us of disinformation and deception by the countries and Hamas and the PLO and the PA as well, that they've been prosecuting really for decades, but it's really picked up since October the 7th massacres.
Yeah, your allusion to the Al-Ahli Hospital incident, the media was very complicit in that, and we saw not just misinformation being propagated, but what I like to point out is that in Tunisia there was a huge demonstration that ended up in the destruction of a synagogue in Tunisia. So that was the result of that little piece of innocent misinformation. But bringing things to the current state of play a little bit, Dan, the fallout from Biden's State of the Union address, a lot of people will have heard him kind of vacillating a bit on his support for Israel. And I should point out to listeners that there is no mention of Iran in his address, which was a very major failing. What do you think about what Biden said, and is it going to have a serious impact on Israel's attempt to take out Hamas?
David, the recent statements of President Biden, who traditionally, for decades, has been a soulmate of Israel. We know that President Biden, Prime Minister Netanyahu, have been friends for 50 years. President Biden, historically, has been a dear, dear friend of the State of Israel, and it comes from his deep Catholic commitment. It comes from a heartfelt commitment to the Jewish people. There have been, in my assessment, terrible political mistakes that have been made in the American discourse, which, as you and I know, has been highly politicized because just hours ago, the presumptive results are in. President Biden is the Democratic candidate for president of the United States re-election campaign 2024, and President Trump, having just secured enough delegates, over 1,200 delegates, in order to become the presumptive Republican candidate. So it is high intensity political discourse, political context in the United States, and that has been driving what we see in Israel as very difficult statements that actually, even without malice aforethought, have delegitimized Israel's ability to really advance its fundamental security needs to defend itself against this barbaric Iranian proxy over our southern border that invaded a sovereign country in the worst mass murder of Jews since the Nazi era, as we know. And his State of the Union address, I think, reflected the great political problems, I think. The American people, David, care about the Russia-Ukraine situation. They care about it, I think, or certainly politically, far more than they care about whether Israel wins or loses. And what I mean by that is not to say that they understand the Russia-Ukraine situation, but in a world that is driven by perception, deception, and misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, for them and for the president, it's easier to sell the American people, the American $100 billion commitment over the last 3 years to the Ukrainian people, as opposed to extraordinarily, as extraordinary as this is, what I'm saying, as opposed to, you know, the Israelis opposite the Iranian octopus. Because today we are living in a political world that is driven by image, that is driven by feeling over fact, that is driven by weak is right and strong is wrong. And extraordinarily, when you look at the Russian bear having gobbled up pieces of its Ukrainian neighbor, beginning in 2014 in Crimea, which was an egregious act of war and a violation of international law. The American people, they back the Ukrainians, but they feel for the Palestinians. They feel because they feel that Israel is the heavy, even though Israel was the Jewish people were attacked. The Jewish people were massacred along with other nationals inside sovereign Israel by an invading terror force. It would be like, you know, whether it would be like 7/7 in London, it would be like 10/4 in Madrid, and it would be like 9/11 in the United States, followed by demands from the international community for Al-Qaeda to set up its own nation state in Englewood, New Jersey, just 2 miles or 3 miles from where Al-Qaeda knocked over the Twin Towers and murdered 4,000 or nearly 4,000 people.
Yeah, what I've heard only in the last day or so, a very senior, unidentified Israeli official is accusing the U.S. government of seeking to oust Netanyahu, that is part of the agenda. That's what Biden is pushing for, because there is a certain coldness that's evident between their relationship in the moment, and I think that's part of the push. What do you reckon about that?
I think we should all be deeply concerned that any country, particularly Israel's best friend, one of Israel's best friends, Australia is a great friend of Israel, but certainly the United States, in terms of its decades-long commitment to maintain Israel's qualitative military edge, in terms of its historic preparedness politically to veto these completely disfigured anti-Semitic, and there's no other way of putting them, anti-Semitic resolutions in the UN Security Council brought by paragons of freedom and democracy like North Korea, like the Iranian regime, like the Pakistanis and others, has done a yeoman's job, if I might say, in protecting Israel on the international scene. Fast forward to where we are today, well, there are clear indications, David, that the United States is meddling in Israeli domestic democratic politics. It's not new. We've known that it's been happening before, but now it's very clear. You know, when Benny Gantz, who is in the Israeli war cabinet, he is a minister without portfolio, former defense minister, former chief of staff, it basically does an end run, to use a football analogy, around the prime minister, runs into the White House to see Vice President Kamala Harris and to see National Security Advisor Sullivan and other major political figures. This is a serious, serious problem. In addition to the fact that it's clear that the United States prefers to work with Benny Gantz, who, by the way, according to the most recent dramatic political events in Israel, has now separated from his political partner, Gideon Saar, who has asked to join the war cabinet, while Gantz is separating from the war cabinet. Benny Gantz is polling in Israel right now at 37 seats, which is where the Likud was in the last election. The Prime Minister Netanyahu's Likud party today is polling at 17 or 18 seats, having lost half of its power. However, never rely on Israeli pre-election polls, because the way the system's set up, it is so fluid, and there are so many actors. There are so many political variables that can happen between now and any potential elections, which my assessment would be will not happen in the coming 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months, as some believe they will. But going back to make the final point, according to your excellent question, the clear meddling of the United States in Israeli domestic politics is not helping the Israel maintain its position as the strongest player in the Middle East, especially after it absorbed this smash in the face, in the collective face, in these atrocities on October 7th, a time where it needs unconditional support from its American allies. And we're not receiving unconditional support. We're receiving conditional support. And in addition to this internal, let's say they've entered into an internal discussion, and they clearly would prefer to work with Benny Gantz, who is through some of his declarations and his profile appear to them to be more to their liking than Netanyahu. And that there is a personal political personality issue between Netanyahu and this American administration, which I think they are mistaken about. However, they will see, David, I think this is the key point, and any of your listeners and viewers who've come to Israel and understand the massive defense and national security complexities that we face opposite the Iranian octopus and all of its tentacles, that there will be no leader that will replace Netanyahu if there are elections and someone else becomes prime minister. Whoever will become prime minister will have, I would assess, almost exactly the same policies that Netanyahu has today opposite this this cauldron of radical Islamic terror that surrounds us and is trying to destroy us.
Yeah, I think that there's something about Gantz going there. He's electioneering, I would say, and the U.S. government is betting on him defeating Netanyahu and being the one that they're going to negotiate with. I want to go to another aspect of the U.S. Support. Israel is saying its assault on Rafah is imminent. There's been no plan yet, though, being put forward about how to evacuate the large number of civilians there. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has reiterated that the U.S. won't support an IDF operation in Rafah unless Israel puts forward a plan to evacuate the over 1 million Palestinians currently sheltering in the city, which Israel hasn't yet done. Do you know what the status of this is? Can you give us any update on this? Because Israel is only going to go in, I would say, until when they've finally got people out of the way.
David, there are private conversations going on throughout the day, every day, between the U.S. administration, its security arms, and their counterparts in Israel. The United States administration knows very well what the situation in Rafah is in terms of Israel's 24/7 efforts to keep civilians out of harm's way. We had the same situation in the north, by which Israel, it was Israel, even with the Hamas trying to kill its own men, women, and children by using them as human shields, by firing on Israel from mosques, from schools, from UN compounds, from residential buildings, from kindergartens, from underneath the tunnels where they would pop up like in a horror film and then pop down firing RPGs at our young men and women who are doing everything they can to help the state of Israel survive and defeat this barbaric death cult that is called the Iranian-backed Hamas. The United States knows that Israel created a humanitarian corridor from northern Gaza into southern Gaza and set up what we call a rescue or an evacuation camp there to keep them out of harm's way in the north as well as in Khan Yunis. And when people throw around the number 30,000 Gazans have died, it is, if you do the math, David, it is the lowest civilian Hamas terrorist casualty rate in the history of guerrilla warfare. If you take the UK and the United States invasion or counteroffensive in Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11, if you take America's counterterrorism operations 20 years in Afghanistan, their operations in Yemen, their operations in Iraq, their operations in Syria, you will find that there were tens of thousands of civilians, children and women that were killed. And Richard Kemp and John Spencer, by the way, who is one of the greatest urban warfare experts in the United States at West Point, they both said, and I want to say it as clearly as I can on your program, there is no country in the world that has taken greater efforts to protect civilian lives in a guerrilla warfare, urban warfare situation than the state of Israel, period, full stop. Now, why those experts have not punctuated the international discourse on urban warfare and guerrilla warfare, it is really beyond me, beyond the fact that Israel is chasing down between 30 and 40,000 Hamas fighters as part of this terrorist death cult, with from building to building, alleyway to alleyway, UN compound to UN compound. And yes, 30,000 Gazans have been killed. But what they do in the Hamas Ministry of Health, I mean, it's an oxymoron. The Hamas Ministry of Health is kind of like the mafia ministry of good governance and anti-corruption. I mean, give us a break, for goodness sakes. In that 30,000 number, and by the way, every life is a tragedy. Every life lost is a tragedy. And you yourself know, as someone of Jewish background, that shalom and the concept of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, is the most important principle in Judaism, and it remains the most important principle in the mouths of our soldiers, including my four children who are fighting for our lives in Gaza, as well as boys and girls of thousands and thousands of other families. However, in that 30,000 person number of Gazans that apparently it's 30,000 that have been killed, some half of them are Hamas fighters. Why doesn't the Hamas Ministry of Health report the number of fighters that have been killed? They hide them. And what they do is they conflate the number, putting everyone in the same number. So if you whittle out the number of Hamas fighters killed, the number of Hamas fighters that have killed their own civilians, the number of people who have died of natural causes anyway, without regard to the war, the number of misfired rockets and missiles and drones that have ended up killing Hamas, you come up with a number that is far less than the number that they quote.
Well, Dan, we could have spoken about a lot of other topics. Unfortunately, we don't have all the time in the world, and you're a busy man. You're off to London, I believe, in a day or two, and you're starting your day, and I'm sure there's a lot on your plate. I thank you very much for giving us some time first up in the morning to tell us what's going on in Israel at the moment.
David, thank you and your viewers ever so much. Please continue to give us. We know that the Jewish community in Australia is one of the toughest, strongest, most resilient Jewish communities in the world, and we welcome Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, which is soon, please God, to become the Jerusalem Center for Foreign Affairs. That's the direction we are de facto right now. But we welcome groups in Australia. As a matter of fact, Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs senior scholar Khaled Abo Toame will be in Australia in about 9 days, meeting with the Jewish community. And he is an extraordinary analyst of Middle East affairs. He's a full-time senior scholar by us, and we are delighted that he'll be joining you in the upcoming days. Continue to read Israeli press, Ynet, Israel Hayom, Jerusalem Post, JNS News. These are good sources for your readers. And thank you for what you do in bringing the truth in good journalism and good analysis to the people of Australia and the rest of the world.
Thank you indeed, Dan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
See you again. Bye-bye. So that was Dan Dyker, who is the president of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Now, Daniel Lukovich is a security expert and the mastermind behind a new documentary in the making, Where's the Jews?, covering what took place at a hateful rally outside the Sydney Opera House on October the 9th. It includes never-before-seen high-quality footage from the Opera House, speeches and images which are shocking, highlighting how this rally was poorly handled by the police, which is symptomatic of a serious malaise in our society. Before I speak with Daniel Lukovich, I'm going to play an audio grab from a trailer that Daniel has produced, which can be viewed on his website, wheresthejews.com. The person you will hear speaking in the clip is Farhad Ali, a sessional academic at the University of Sydney whose brand of political activism is particularly virulent. Farhad Ali is a member of the Palestine Justice Movement in Sydney who told the media on the night of October the 9th outside the Opera House that there were just a few bad apples amongst the anti-Israel protesters. He was reported as having condemned anti-Semitic elements in the crowd and said anyone looking to start trouble was not welcome in the movement. Anyone listening to his incendiary speech in the audio clip we are about to hear would be hard-pressed to say that Farhad Ali wasn't actually promoting anti-Semitism. I hope that Daniel Lukovich's film will put pressure on authorities to prosecute Farhad Ali for inciting hatred and trying to stir up violence in our society. Farhad Ali is a particularly poisonous anti-Israeli activist who plays an instrumental role 2 years ago in the controversy over the sponsorship deal with the Israel embassy supporting the Sydney Dance Company at the Sydney Festival. Let's listen now.
Is because there is very little that I see in the conflict, in the war, in the aggression of the Zionist regime onto our people that moves me to tears. But this morning I cried. And the reason I cried was because I was so overjoyed to see the amount of support that we now have. It was only when all else had failed, when all channels of peaceful protest had been barred to us, that the decision was made to embark on violent forms of political struggle. Governments, including the government of this colonial entity that we call Australia, are tripping over themselves to outlaw, boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Israel. Resistance is always justified for as long as Palestine is occupied. For exploding. Palestinians have every right to break down our cage. We have every right to fight back. And for the first time in 75 years, we've actually taken back our land. I'm not going to stand before you and shed tears over the settlers, the terrified settlers. Colonialism is violence. in its most natural state, and will only be overcome with greater violence.
So I welcome you, Daniel Lukowitz, to the Israel Connection on JA Community Radio, coming to you from Melbourne, Australia.
Thanks, David. It's good to speak to a friendly audience for a change.
We just heard an audio grab from footage that you are in the process of assembling into a film to be titled Where's the Jews? And we'll talk about it in just a moment. But before we get into the detail about your film project, Where's the Jews, with which you're involved, please tell us something about yourself. What's your background? What is motivating you to make a film about what happened outside the Opera House on October the 9th? And is this your first venture into filmmaking, Daniel?
David, I've spent probably over two decades professionally in security and risk management. That's crossed over into anti-terrorism. I've been studying terrorism for most of my career, certainly done an awful lot of pro bono work within the Sydney Jewish community and other at-risk communities. And this was from a time pre-9/11, even prior to the Sydney Olympics, when local law enforcement really didn't have any particular understanding of terrorism. And, you know, I've been studying this for the bulk of my career. So I'm not a newcomer to understanding threats. I've worked with police very closely. I have police as friends. I have police as professional colleagues. I've done work for the police. I have trained police. And what I saw on the 9th of October, within a day or two of the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, to me represented one of the greatest policing failures in Australian history. To me, there were three big failures. The first failure was prior to lighting the sails of the Sydney Opera House with the Israeli flag, when they said to the Jewish community, it's not safe in the city, you need to stay away. That represents a major failure of police and government. The second failure was when a riot broke out at the Sydney Opera House. And when you had people displaying the flags of prohibited terrorist organizations, you had people openly inciting violence against Jews. You had people even firing flares at police, and police stood there doing nothing. That represented a major failure in policing. And the third thing is that, having seen all of that evidence, the incitement, the hatred, the vitriol of what was fundamentally an illegal gathering in the first place, violence toward police as well, the police have basically done nothing. In fact, the only person that was arrested that day was a young Jewish man for carrying an Israeli flag through the city. And yet this sent a message to a very, very hostile group saying, you're in control of the streets, you're in charge, you can do whatever you want. And that is a very, very dangerous signal to be sending these groups. But the icing on the cake was when Mal Lanyon, one of the deputy commissioners of the police, who's, you know, certainly had a bit of a colourful career over the last few years, got up and essentially gaslit the entire community by saying, oh, no, no one said gas the Jews. It was, where's the Jews? Now, there's a couple of real problems with that. The first one is, I cannot remember in all my years the police calling a press conference to say nothing happened. Police will call a press conference when they've got information they want to relay, when they have an announcement to make, when they've had a high-profile bust. I can't remember the last time police called a press conference specifically to say nothing happened, there's nothing to see here. And it would seem to me a poorly calculated political move to essentially pour cold water over the whole thing and deny what's there in plain sight, which is that we have Islamic Jihad on the streets of Sydney. Now, I have got abundant video evidence of that, some of which you just played in that clip, but much of which has never been seen, which is going to really wake a few people up. And I think there's a few people who should be very, very nervous about what's going to be revealed. And it's really going to become a time where Australians need to decide, is this something that we're going to permit within our society, because we have the benefit of hindsight of 10, 15 years in, for example, Europe, in London, where we can see what happens if these trends aren't nipped in the bud. And there are two very, very, very big red flags for the Jewish community. The first one is that this sort of thing actually happens on the streets, people openly calling for violence against Jews. The second red flag is when the government and law enforcement stand idly by while that happens. Those are very, very big red flags for the Jewish community, but not just the Jewish community, the broader community, because as anybody who has studied this will know, it's the Jews first and then it's everybody else later. There's an expression, it's one of the, I think it's a Christian or a Maronite group, but they say, first it's the Saturday people, then it's the Sunday people that the Friday people will come for. And if you're not paying attention to this, you're going to have a real problem. So it's my hope with Where's the Jews that this is going to really open a few people's eyes. And it's not even about the Arab-Israeli conflict. I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion there, and it's obviously a very complicated issue. It's simply about the fact that within 24 hours of the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, there was a protest planned, and I call it a protest, but given that Israel had not actually done anything at that stage, they hadn't fired a single shot, this was nothing less than a celebration of mass murder and rape of Jews. And that didn't happen in Ramallah. It didn't happen in Gaza. That happened in Sydney. And that's not okay.
Well, it's certainly clear from what you've just been saying, Daniel, that you're highly motivated. Just one question you didn't get to. Is this the first time you've made a venture into making a film to put your message out?
Well, yeah, yes and no. When I was a kid, I used to actually make some pocket money shooting wedding videos and bar mitzvah videos and things like that. And I actually did work experience in television once upon a time. But I think I kind of got steered away from the arts by my parents and ended up going into university and IT and then subsequently security. But it's certainly something that I found a fascinating journey. And I think what's also been interesting is that we're crowdfunding this film. And your listeners can go to wheresthejews.com if they'd like to see a trailer and if they'd like to donate. And I've been very, very impressed by the number of people who have made donations who I can tell, you know, either from their name or perhaps messages that they sent. They're not Jewish. They're not the traditional donors to this sort of thing, but they're just people who are very concerned about the direction that the country is going, and they've gotten behind the project. But I tell you, one of the things that I've learned is that this is a really, really expensive process. And so, you know, any assistance from people in helping this see daylight, I think would be greatly appreciated, because it's an important story that needs to be told. And these warnings need to be shown before people wish they'd been told.
Yes, I can also tell you that I'm do a little bit of filmmaking myself. I'm not out there in the same level of seriousness as you, but sometimes my programs that I do, which are ostensibly for radio, I put on a YouTube channel because I think there's a visual element that will enhance them. And I've just done an interview this week with Joseph Browder, who's from the Center for Peace Communications, where we're looking at voices that are coming out of Gaza. And it's important, I think, to show some clips in conjunction with the words, just to show now, because in the past he did work which only was able to be revealed through animations. But now he's actually got examples of people who are actually doing things out there even under the threat of what Hamas could inflict upon them. Anyway, we're digressing a little bit.
This is one of the interesting observations out of the Middle East. I think many progressive and certainly left and far left activists in the Western world completely take their freedom for granted, and they don't realize how easy it is to say things with no fear of reprisal. I mean, we saw at the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras last week, possibly one of the greatest displays of cognitive dissonance of all time, because you have far left activists there who are waving the Palestinian flag and essentially supporting a culture that would see them murdered. And they don't seem to get that. But, you know, you'll often see at the Mardi Gras, for example, they will vilify nuns. They will vilify the church. They will vilify Christianity. And a gay Christian friend of mine hates it, because he says that when the AIDS epidemic was at its peak in the 80s, the only people that would touch people with AIDS were actually the nurses. And yet the Mardi Gras walks past the hospice demonizing those people. But they do so in complete safety, knowing that nothing will ever happen. Whereas people who speak out against the negative aspects of Islam potentially face death for doing so. When you hear voices coming, particularly out of the Middle East, particularly coming out of Gaza, these people are potentially risking their life by saying these things. And it's very, very important that they be given a platform, that they be given a voice, that people listen to what they're saying. Because, I mean, what's been remarkable looking at this conflict over the last few months is that the Arab world, by and large, has tended to stay quiet, and they've tended to stay out of it. So I think they actually know what's going on. And so instead, Hamas is relying on Marxist groups and basically useful idiots in the West to tell the story for them. When the Arab world is not putting its hand up to support Hamas, and yet you've got supposedly university-educated people in Australia becoming the useful idiots for Hamas, that's a real problem. But when you hear dissident voices who are going to become stronger and stronger as Hamas potentially becomes less of a mortal threat to them, it's really important that we listen to what they're saying, and that that doesn't get drowned out in the noise by people who simply don't have a solid understanding of this. You know, they just graduated from the Twitter School of Middle Eastern Studies 2 weeks ago, and they're just blindly resharing stuff on social media with no fundamental understanding of what's going on. It's very important that you listen to the small voices in this, because at the end of the day, people in the West who say, you know, well, this is what Israel should do, Israel should do this, or they, you know, they show their support for Hamas, or, you know, they call it the Palestinians. They have no skin in the game. They stand to lose nothing. I mean, you can walk up Oxford Street at the gay Mardi Gras waving a Palestinian flag. You're not going to get thrown to your death off the top of a building. You have no skin in the game. But over in Israel, a mistake in national security, a mistake in defense, a failure of policy, or just leaving Hamas there represents a mortal threat. So all these people in Australia or the West, you know, demanding that Israel have a ceasefire or demanding that Israel do this or Israel do that, they stand to lose nothing. But over the other side of the border, you know, in Gaza, there are people there who stand to lose everything for speaking out. And I think they're finally finding their voice. And those are the voices we should absolutely be listening to. And those voices should not be drowned out by the kind of rhetoric that we heard at protests in Sydney, that we saw at riots at the Sydney Opera House, and that we see in an endless bunch of tired media that seems to essentially say, well, you know, yes, Jews got murdered or raped, but who cares, because they brought it on themselves. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying. And for the left-wing activists, it's particularly hypocritical, because, you know, these are people who not a year ago were saying, believe all women, and trying to completely shape a national dialogue around violence against women, which in many respects is commendable. And yet when Jews are raped, they just look somewhere else. So it's like, believe all women except Jews. Jews don't count. And that's not okay.
The Jews don't count. That's certainly the thing that always comes to mind. That's David Baddiel's book and documentary that he produced on that very title. What the mainstream media is, actually complicit in this. I don't think I've seen any reportage by the mainstream media of any dissenting voices coming out of Gaza. Not one.
Well, I mean, I think, look, part of the problem is just simple ignorance by journalists. I mean, one of the things that I've found is that there's probably two issues. One is the Middle East, and the other is gun control, that every single person seems to have a strong and completely inflexible opinion on, even though probably 1% of the population really understand what they're talking about. And If you went to a group of people and you said, who do you support in the conflict in Eritrea, you'd get a blank stare. And if you said, okay, so which side do you support in the civil war in Sudan, you'd get a blank stare. And if you said to them, well, who do you support in Russia and Ukraine, they'd put their hand up and go, oh, I know that one. And you go, okay, and who do you support in the conflict around Yemen and Syria? And you'd get a blank stare. And then you go, well, what about Israel and the Palestinians? And they go, oh, I know that one, right? And the reason they seem to know this, and everybody from a D-list celebrity to a clueless journalist seem to have an opinion on this, is because the entire sort of narrative has been boiled down to there's a good guy and there's a bad guy. So, you know, Russia is the bad guy and Ukraine is the good guy. People can sort of pick a side there and they can deal with it, even though, you know, anybody who's actually studied history or studies geopolitics or studies warfare understands that these things are actually a lot more complicated than that. And the Arab-Israeli conflict is probably the greatest example. And I think one of my favorite theories at the moment is that the Russian bot farms, which we haven't heard about since the last US election, have just been forgotten about. But it's not a big stretch of the imagination to assume that it would suit Russia to have the entire world looking somewhere else right now. And so, you know, if the whole of social media is fighting over what's happening in the Middle East, they're basically ignoring what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. And so if people don't learn to kind of zoom out and look at the bigger picture, or sometimes just realize their own lack of knowledge and just kind of sit down and be quiet, I think that's very important. I can't understand why people here are so worked up about one particular issue, but they're not, you know, they're not equally frustrated by, you know, Yemen or Syria or anything else. The Kingdom of Jordan lined up and killed about 25,000 Palestinians in Black September. Now, no one's ever heard about that. But, you know, when Israel does something, you hear all about it. Now, there's no question that a lot of that is motivated by anti-Semitism, but I don't think it's entirely that simple, because I think there's a lot of people who, they're just simply not that educated, they're not that cluey. But once upon a time when you didn't know what the hell you were talking about, you just kind of sit down and be quiet. But now in an age of social media, you know, you're expected to pick a side, you're expected to pin a flag emoji to your bio, you're expected to have a position on everything. And it's not just individuals, it's businesses. You know, every business now has to have an opinion on this and an opinion on that, when most people actually just simply don't know what they're talking about. And in that information vacuum and in that knowledge vacuum, that's where great lies can be spread. And, you know, you will get activists who will stand up and say something that is just flat out lies. A journalist or someone who's not necessarily inherently bad or anti-Semitic or evil, they're just ignorant, will just kind of let it go through to the keeper. That's a failure of education. It certainly means the Jewish community should be looking very hard at how they teach the Holocaust, how they teach anti-Semitism, because I think there are some real lessons to be learned there in how all of this is addressed. I mean, I was in Los Angeles a few months ago, and I visited the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, and that's predominantly a Holocaust museum. While I was there, there was a school group going through ahead of me, and unfortunately, I think those kids were absolutely bored shitless. That's a real problem in the way we teach this stuff, in the way education happens. And, you know, I almost think that perhaps the millions of dollars that are spent in these education programs could just simply be directed to making TikToks, because perhaps that's the way to engage with people and teach them that the people who think they're the good guys, the people who think they're supporting the resistance, that they're supporting the oppressed, are in fact marching in lockstep with people who are doing things that would actually make the Nazis blush. Because during the Holocaust, the Nazis tried to conceal what they were doing from the whole rest of the world. They didn't want the world to know what they're doing, whereas Hamas wanted the world to know what they were doing. They live streamed it. And you've got people here who are marching in lockstep with that and don't realize that they're actually siding with one of the most evil groups that has ever existed. And the reason they don't understand that is because they don't know what the warning signs are. They don't know what the red flags are. And they've just allowed themselves to be captivated by a very, very pernicious movement that has brainwashed these people into thinking that this is a simple case of good versus evil and they're on the side of good, without stopping for a minute and going, hang on a minute, how can this be good when this side is also raping women, murdering children, making young people watch as their family is slaughtered? I mean, you cannot tell me that that is resistance. You can't. And yet that's exactly what's happened here. And indeed, you know, you have Palestinian activists in Australia who keep using this word resistance, which really might appeal to the young university demographic, the types who once upon a time would have walked around campus with a Che Guevara shirt on and so forth, but and think, you know, Marxism is really cool, with oblivious to the millions of deaths that communism has caused. So these are buzzwords. They hear about resistance, they hear about oppression, and they hear about colonialism. And, you know, and then there's this absolutely absurd attempt to kind of conflate every single global issue. So, you know, it's Indigenous Australia and it's British imperialism and it's American imperialism and it's Middle Eastern. And they try to sort of merge all of these together to say, well, okay, so if you're against this, therefore you should support this. And so if you support closing the gap with Indigenous Australians, therefore you have to oppose Israel. And I mean, that is hugely, hugely insulting to Indigenous activists in Australia. It's hugely insulting to the work that the Jewish community has done to support the Indigenous community in Australia. And it's just simple ignorance of history, but ignorance is where evil flourishes. And so I think people are kind of relying on this. So they're not educating people. They're not teaching people how to think. They're just saying, well, this is what you should think. And these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, so pick a side. And that's just a really, really dangerous environment. And the proof of that, very simply, is that young people who think they're good, who think they support human rights, who think they support freedom, are marching hand in hand with people who rape and murder Jews.
So how do you think that your film that you're producing is going to make any inroads into this ignorance that you're clearly incensed about?
Well, I'm not planning to explore the whole history of conflict in the Middle East, and I'm certainly not planning to explore this entire conflict here. And frankly, there's been so many tens of thousands of hours already, I'm not sure that mildly disinterested people have the time to watch. I want to focus very much on what happened in Sydney. And it's my hope that, first of all, this is going to expose a few things that I think a lot of people would prefer stayed buried. And I won't talk too much about that. But it's also my hope that this is going to cause the police to have a very serious conversation about what is and what isn't permissible on Australian streets. And hopefully over the long term, it's going to cause a lot of people to think, well, hang on, how did we get to this stage? Because this didn't happen overnight. It's not as though the day before that protest, people just jumped on Amazon.com and ordered flags of prohibited Islamist organizations or learn these chants and so forth. I mean, this has been going on for a very, very long time, and it's like the frog in the boiling pot. Nobody sort of noticed it. But it's my hope that we can have these discussions and we can try and find solutions to this, rather than after there being some sort of horrific incident or accident and then everybody turning around and wondering, oh my gosh, how did this happen? Well, you know, there are people waving big red flags right now, and people need to start paying attention to that. So it's my hope that Where's the Jews will bring this discussion to the forefront, and it will allow people to actually think very hard about what they want Australia to look like going into the future, because these things take decades to appear and they can take decades to solve. In some respect, what happened at the Sydney Opera House was basically paying with interest for very bad policy and immigration decisions that were made in this country several decades ago. I'm certainly not opposed to immigration. I'm the product of immigration, but the entire debate in this country has always been, again, this really sort of polarized thing where you either believe let everybody in, no borders, or no immigration, let nobody in. And it's sort of one or the other, rather than a very nuanced conversation, which is, well, what should positive, beneficial migration to this country look like? And what should we be attracting? And what should we be rejecting? And I'm very, very concerned when you have a government anywhere in the world that is far more concerned about getting elected or getting re-elected than they are about doing what's right and doing what's in a nation's best interests. And so there's a question, for example, I mean, our current government, the Australian Labor Party, is it really about Gaza or is it about Graindler? Because we've seen situations in the past where governments have looked to increase votes in a particular area rather than doing what's right, because we have a culture where politicians sort of want to stay in their job and may not actually make what's in the national interest. And that's very, very dangerous as well. So hopefully I can trigger a discussion, and not one that people talk about for a couple of weeks and then it falls out of the news cycle, but one that can truly, genuinely shape the direction of this country, because I want this country to be prosperous. I want this country to be successful. I want this country to be a safe place for Jews and for everybody else. And the only way that's going to happen is if people kind of wake up from their slumber and they go, this is a problem, let's fix it while we still can, rather than just kind of hit the snooze button, roll over and go back to sleep until the next time there's a catastrophe and then wish they'd done something about it, by which time it could be too late. And we can already see evidence of that in Europe, where the horse has bolted. There's no point now shutting the gate. That is deeply, deeply unfortunate. It is something that absolutely needs to be avoided here. And so if I can promote that discussion, that would be a wonderful outcome. But if nothing else, if I can cause the police and the government to think we really screwed up here and encourage them to do better, I think that would be a good thing as well. So I would encourage listeners to go to wheresthejews.com, where they can view trailers, they can view interviews, and of course they can also donate and share it around, because people really need to see this and they need to understand what's happening right under our nose.
Well, Daniel, you're one of the easiest persons that I've ever had to interview. All I need to do is sit back and leave the microphone to you. I hardly need to get involved at all. I have had a number of further questions to explore with you, but I think you've really rounded things off very well with the remarks that you just tailed off with then. Just before we wrap it all up, when do you expect your film Where's the Jew to be ready?
At the moment, we have to raise a lot of money. That's going to have a direct impact on how quickly we can produce this. This won't be done justice if it's just something that goes up on YouTube. This requires a lot of work, even just the legals involved, making sure that we're doing everything properly, interviews with people, the research that's required over and above the film production. It costs a lot. We're not quite up there with a Marvel movie and millions and millions and millions of dollars, but every little bit helps. So if people could go to wheresthejews.com and chip in, that'd be really appreciated.
All right. We'll certainly post it up on the program's Facebook page and through other publicity channels that the Israel Connection follows. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Daniel.
Thanks, David.
You've been listening to Daniel Lukovits, who is a security expert and the mastermind behind a new documentary in the making, Where's the Jews? Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.